stretching. Gramps never looked at my clothes. I didn't wait around to see if her eyes would find their way back and if the right words would follow. I heard Mabel's door slam and I ran up after her. She was digging through her drawers and saying how stupid all her clothes were, even the good things, but I didn't listen because I was trying to figure out what to do. I had the pair of jeans that I'd worn over, but my shirt was too plain. So I took off the dress and picked up the scissors Mabel kept on her desk, and I cut the dress right below the waist.
"What are you doing?" Mabel said. "You don't have to change."
"It'll look better like this anyway," I said. I pulled the jeans up and tucked in the fraying seam of what used to be a dress. I looked in the mirror and it was true. It looked better. And when we went back downstairs, Javier complimented Mabel's new outfit and kissed her on the forehead, while she muttered, "Whatever," and rolled her eyes. And Anna jumped up from her place on the sofa and took my hands.
"You look beautiful," she said. "Good choice."
I was buoyant with gratitude as we left the house. Mabel's parents called their reminders that we take a car home, not ride with our friends if they'd been drinking, not walk if it was after 11. We called back our okays. I drifted down Guerrero Street, a girl with her best friend. A maker of good choices. Too many people were at Ben's house. They crowded the foyer and the kitchen, made it difficult to hear anything anyone said to us. Mabel gestured to the kitchen, and I shook my head. It wasn't worth it. I caught a glimpse of Ben in the living room and grabbed Mabel's hand. "Where's Lainey?" I asked him when we were settled there on the soft green rug, the city lights through the windows. The nostalgia of everything taking me over. In seventh grade, Ben and I had spent a few months kissing each other until we realized we had more fun talking. I hadn't been in that room with him for a long time. But even with everyone else there and the loudness of it, the way people were showing off for one another and getting wilder, I remembered our mellow afternoons, just him and me and the dog. Once we discovered that we were meant to be just friends.
"I shut her in my parents' room," he said. "She gets nervous around too many people. You could go say hi to her, though, if you want. You remember where the treats are?"
"Yeah," I said. "I do." It had been years, but I could picture the tin of dog treats on a shelf next to a stack of cookbooks. I wove my way past the groups of people and into the hall by the kitchen. And there was the tin, just as I'd remembered. Ben's parents' room was quiet, and Lainey whimpered when I walked in. I closed the door behind me and sat on the carpet, fed her 5 treats, one after the next, the way we used to do when Ben and I were 13. I stayed in there, petting her head for a little bit longer, because it felt special to be somewhere other people weren't allowed to go. When I got back to the living room and sat between Mabel and Ben, they were in the midst of a conversation with Courtney and a few other people.
"We're basically the only teenagers in the city," a boy said. "All the private schools are worried because they're losing students every year."
Courtney said, "We might move."
"What?"
Ben shook his head.
"You've been my neighbor for, like, ever."
"I know, it's crazy. But I share a room with my brother, and it's not that cool anymore. When he was a little kid, fine. But now that he's hitting puberty, not so much."
"Where would you go?"
I asked her. San Francisco always felt like an island to me, surrounded by the mythical East Bay with its restaurants and parks, and North Bay with its wealth and its redwoods. South of the city was where our dead were buried, but not my mother, whose ashes returned to the ocean that killed her, which was also the ocean she loved. South of that were little beach towns, and then Silicon Valley and Stanford. But the people, everyone I knew, everyone I'd ever known, all lived in the city.
"Contra Costa," Courtney said.
"Gross,"
Ben said.
"You've probably never even been there." "You're probably right."
"Snob!" Courtney punched his leg. "It's fine there. A lot of trees. I'm just so ready to have 3 bedrooms."
We have three bedrooms. It can't be that hard to find. Maybe go out to the sunset. That's where Marin lives.
How big is your place? Courtney asked me. It's a house, I said. It's pretty big. I think three bedrooms.
What do you mean you think?
My grandpa lives in the back and I live in the front. I think there are two rooms back there. Maybe three.
Courtney's eyes narrowed.
You haven't been in the back of your house?
It's not that weird, I said. He has a study and a bedroom, but the bedroom opens up to something. Either a big closet or a small room. I'm just not sure if it's technically a bedroom or not.
Bedrooms have to have closets or else they aren't considered bedrooms, Eleanor, daughter of real estate agent parents, informed us.
Oh, I said. Then it's a three-bedroom. It doesn't have a closet.
It's probably a sitting room, Eleanor offered. Lots of the old houses have them off the master bedrooms.
I nodded. But the truth is that I wasn't sure at all. I'd only caught glimpses through his study a couple times, but that's just how it was with us. I gave him his privacy, and he gave me mine.
Mabel would have loved that arrangement. Anna was always digging through her drawers. But as the night got later, as people showed up and left, and the music got turned down because of the neighbors, and the alcohol flowed and then ran out, I kept seeing Courtney's look, her narrowed eyes, the tone of her voice.
You haven't been in the back of your house?
She was right. I hadn't been there. I'd only paused in the doorway some nights when he was in his study, sitting at his desk, smoking his cigarettes, tapping the ash in his crystal ashtray, and writing his letters by the light of an old-fashioned desk lamp, green with a bronze chain. Most of the time the door was shut, but once in a while it was left open a crack. By mistake, probably. Sometimes I'd call, "Good night," and he would say it back. But most of the time I walked quietly by, trying not to disturb him, until I got to our shared territory, and then to my room, where nobody ever went besides Mabel and me.
"What's wrong?" Mabel asked me when we were back on the sidewalk, waiting for the car under a street lamp. I shook my head.
"Courtney was being kind of aggressive."
I shrugged. "It doesn't matter." I was still thinking about Gramps at his desk. I was still wondering why I tried to be quiet when I walked past his rooms. I was only giving him privacy. He was old, and the whites of his eyes seemed to grow more yellow every week, and he coughed like something was ready to rattle loose inside of him. A week ago, I saw a red spot on his handkerchief when he lowered it from his mouth. He needed rest and quiet. He needed to save his strength. I was only being considerate. It's what anyone would do. But still, doubts, doubts.
The car pulled up and we slid into the back. The driver eyed Mabel in the rearview mirror as she gave him her address. He smiled, said something to her in Spanish, his tone so flirtatious I didn't need a translation. She rolled her eyes.
"Mexico?"
he asked her.
"Sí." "Colombia," he said.
100 Years of Solitude is one of my favorite books. I was embarrassed before the sentence was even finished. Just because he was from Colombia didn't mean that he'd care. He adjusted the mirror and looked at me for the first time.
"You like Garcia Marquez?"
"I love him. Do you?"
"Love? No. Admire? Yes."
He turned right onto Valencia. A burst of laughter reached us from the sidewalk, still teeming with people.
100 Años de Soledad, he said. "Your favorite.
Really? Is it that hard to believe?
Many people love that book. But you are so young."
Mabel said something in Spanish. I slapped her leg and she grabbed my hand, held it tight.
"I just said you were too smart for your own good," she said.
"Oh," I smiled at her. "Thanks."
"Inteligente, okay?"
he said.
Yes, but that is not why I ask.
All the incest? I asked.
Ha!
That too, but no. He pulled up to Mabel's house, and I wished he would circle the block. Mabel was pressed against me. She'd let go of my hand, but we were still touching. And I didn't know why it felt so good, but I knew I didn't want it to stop. And the driver was trying to tell me something about the book I'd read so many times, the one I kept discovering and trying to understand better. I wished he'd circle all night. Mabel's body and mine would relax into each other's. The car would fill with ideas about the passionate, tortured Buendia family. The once grand city of Macondo, the way Garcia Marquez wove magic into so many sentences. But he put the car in park. He turned around to see me better.
I do not mean the difficulty. I do not mean the sex. I mean there are too many failings. Not enough hope. Everything is despair. Everything is suffering. What I mean is don't be a person who seeks out grief. There is enough of that in life.
And then it was over. The car ride and the discussion. Mabel's body against mine. And we were letting ourselves into her garden, and I was trying to call it back. The night was suddenly colder, and Courtney's voice was in my head again. I wanted it out. We climbed the stairs to Mabel's room, and she shut the door.
"So was he right?" she asked me. "Are you the kind of person who seeks out grief, or do you just like that book?"
"I don't know," I told her. "I don't think I'm that kind of person."
"I don't either," she said. "But it was an interesting thing to say."
I thought that it was more likely the opposite. I must have shut grief out. Found it in books, cried over fiction instead of the truth. The truth was unconfined, unadorned. There was no poetic language to it, no yellow butterflies, no epic floods. There wasn't a town trapped underwater or generations of men with the same name, destined to repeat the same mistakes. The truth was vast enough to drown in.
"You seem distracted," Mabel said.
"Just thirsty," I lied. "I'll get us water." I walked barefoot down the stairs to the kitchen and flipped on the light. I crossed to the cabinet for the glasses and turned to fill them when I saw that on the island, Anna had propped up her collage with a note in front of it that read, "Gracias, Marin. This was exactly what I needed." Black satin, the remnants of my dress, now made waves at the bottom of the canvas. It was a black night, a black ocean, but the kitchen light sparked flecks of fool's gold stars, and out of the waves burst hand-painted shells, white and pink, the kind my mother loved. I stared at it, drank my glass of water and filled it up again. I kept looking for a long time, but I couldn't think of a single thing it might mean.
Chapter 8. I understand what a New York winter storm is now. We are safely inside my room, but outside snow pours, not drifts, from the sky. The ground is disappearing. No more roads. No more paths. The tree branches are heavy and white, and Mabel and I are dorm-bound. It was good that we went out early. Good we came back when we did. It's only one, and we won't be going anywhere for a long time.
"I'm tired," Mabel says. "Or maybe it's just good napping weather." I wonder if she's dreading the rest of the hours in this day. Maybe she wishes she hadn't come. I think I'll close my eyes, too, try to sleep away the sick feeling, the whisper that I am a waste of her time, her money, her effort. But the whisper only gets louder. Mabel's breaths deepen and steady with sleep, and I am awake, mind swarming. I didn't answer her texts. I didn't return her calls or even listen to her voicemails. She came all the way to New York to invite me home with her, and I can't even tell her yes. A waste. A waste. I lie like this for an hour, until I can't do it any longer. I can make this better. There is still time left. When I get back to my room 20 minutes later, I'm carrying 2 plates of quesadillas, perfectly browned on both sides, topped with sour cream and salsa. I have 2 grapefruit sparkling waters nestled between my elbow and my ribs. I push open my door, grateful to see Mabel awake. She's sitting on Hannah's bed, staring out the window. Pure white. The whole world must be freezing. As soon as she sees me, she jumps up to help with the plates and bottles. "I woke up starving," she says. "The stores here don't have crema," I say. "Hope sour cream is okay." She takes a bite and nods her approval. We open our cans. A pop. A hiss. I try to determine what the feeling is between us at the moment, and hope that something has changed, that we could be, for a little while, at ease with each other. We eat in hungry silence, punctuated by a couple comments about the snow. I wonder if we will become okay again. I hope for it. Mabel crosses to the darkening window to look at my peperomia. "There's pink on the edges of these leaves," she says. "I didn't notice before. Let's see how it looks in your new pot." She reaches toward the bag from the pottery studio. "Don't look," I say. "There's something for you in there." "What do you mean? I saw everything you bought." "Not everything," I say, grinning. She's happy, impressed with me. She's looking at me the way she used to. "I have something for you, too," she says. "But it's at home, so you'll have to come back with me to get it." Without meaning to, I break our gaze. "Marin," she says, "is there something I don't know about? Some recently discovered family members? Some secret society or cult or something? Because as far as I know, you have no one, and I'm offering you something really huge and really good." "I know. I'm sorry. I thought that you liked my parents." "Of course I like them." "Look at this," she says, picking up her phone. "My mom texted it to me. It was going to be a surprise." She turns the screen toward me. My name, painted in Anna's whimsical lettering on a door. "My own room? They redid the whole thing for you." I know why she's angry. It should be so simple to say yes. And I want to. The walls of their guest room are vibrant blue, not a paint color, but the pigment of the plaster itself. The wood floors are perfectly worn. You never have to worry about scratching them. I can imagine myself there, a permanent guest in my guest room, walking barefoot into the kitchen to pour myself mugs of coffee or glasses of water. I would help them make their delicious feasts, gather handfuls of sage and thyme from their front porch herb garden. I can imagine how it would look to live there, and I know the things I would do. But I can't feel it. I can't say yes. I have only just learned how to be here. Life is paper thin and fragile. Any sudden change could rip it wide open. The swimming pool, certain shops on a certain street, Stop and Shop, this dorm, the buildings that house my classes, all of these are as safe as it gets, which is still not nearly safe enough. When leaving campus, I never turn right, because it would take me too close to the motel. I can't fathom boarding a plane to San Francisco. It would be flying into ruins. But how could I begin to explain this to her? Even the good places are haunted. The thought of walking up her stairs to her front door or onto the 31 bus leaves me heavy with dread. I can't even think about my old house or Ocean Beach without panic thrumming through me. "Hey," she says, voice soft. "Are you okay?" I nod, but I don't know if it's true. The silence of my house, the food left untouched on the counter, the sharp panic of knowing I was alone. "You're shaking," she says. "I need to swim, that plunge into water, that quiet." I close my eyes and try to feel it.
"Marin, what's going on?"
"I'm just trying," I say.
"Trying what?"
"Can you tell me something?"
"Sure."
"Anything. Tell me about one of your classes."
"Okay. I'm taking art history.
I think I might minor in it. I really love the Mexican art, which makes my mom so happy. Like Frida Kahlo. Her paintings are so strong. There are all the self-portraits, close-ups of her face and shoulders with variations, like sometimes she has animals with her. Monkeys, a weird hairless dog, that kind of thing. And some are more simple."
"Is this right? Am I helping?"
I nod. "My current favorite is called The Two Fridas. It's pretty much the way it sounds. There are two versions of her, sitting next to each other on a bench. One is wearing a long white dress with an elaborate lace bodice and collar, and the other one is dressed in... I don't remember exactly. Something more relaxed. But the thing that I really like about it is you can see their hearts. You can see right into their chests. Or maybe their hearts are outside their chests. It's kind of gruesome, like most of her paintings, but it's also really dramatic and beautiful."
"I'd like to see it."
"I can pull it up if you want me to. Hold on one second." I open my eyes. We are in my room. My hands are still. She's taking my computer off my desk and entering a search. She sits down next to me and positions the screen between us, resting it on one of my knees and one of hers. The painting is how she described it. But there's also more. Behind the two Fridas are storm clouds, gray-blue and white.
"I can't tell," I say, "if the trouble is coming, or if it's past and already left them."
"Or maybe they're in the middle of it," she says. "Something is happening with the hearts." The hearts are connected by a thin red line, a vein. It's bleeding onto the Frida in the white dress, who is holding a pair of scissors. I point to her heart. "We're looking inside her chest to see it," I say. "And it looks painful. But the other one?" I point to her. "I think her heart's outside her body. It's still whole."
"You're right," Mabel says.
"Where the one in the white dress has scissors, this one has something else."
"What is she holding?"
"It's a tiny portrait of Diego Rivera. She painted this during their divorce."
"So it's about losing him," I say.
"Yeah, I guess," she says. "That's what my professor says. But doesn't that make it too simple?" I turn my head to look at Mabel.
"It's better if it's complicated," I say.
She smiles.
"Well, obviously."
I take another look at the screen.
"Maybe it really is as simple as it looks, though. She was one person before. She had a whole heart and the man she loved. She was at ease. And then something happened, and it changed her. And now she's wounded."
"Are you trying to tell me something?" Mabel says. "Are you finally answering me? If you need to do it this way, I'd be happy to find a bunch of paintings for you to analyze."
"No," I say. "I mean, yes. I know how she feels. But that's not what I'm doing. I'm just looking at your painting."
"The thing I most love about it," Mabel says, "is how they're holding hands right at the center of the painting. It's so important. It's what the whole thing's about, I think."
"It could mean so many different things."
"Like what?" "I just think it means the Fridas are still connected. Even though she's changed, she's still the same person."
"Yeah, it could mean that," I say.
but it could also be something else. Like the whole one is trying to pull the wounded one back to her, as if she could undo what's happened. Or the wounded one is guiding her old self into her new life. Or it could be that they've separated almost entirely from each other, and they are holding hands as a last moment of connection, before they break apart completely. Mabel stares at the image. "And why are you changing your major?" she asks. "Because wouldn't it be better," I say, "if the hand-holding really just meant they were connected, and you didn't have to think about the other possibilities?" "No," she says, "not at all. That would not, in any way, be better than realizing that there are many ways to see one thing. I love this painting even more now." She sets the computer down on the bed. She stands up and glares down at me. "Seriously?" she says. "Natural sciences?" And then, everything goes dark. Chapter 9. We decide we shouldn't worry, because even though it's cold and getting colder in here, we have jackets and blankets. If it comes to it, we can pick locks and scavenge for candles. For now, we have a few tea lights from Hannah's drawer. Our cell phones still have some charge left, but we're using them sparingly, and there's no Wi-Fi anyway. "Remember when the power went out sophomore year?" Mabel asks. "I made you listen to me read all night. Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton." "Right. Those were dark poems." "Yeah, but they were fun, too." "They were defiant," I say. "I remember the sparks in them. I remember how the words made me feel dangerous and strong. Lady Lazarus and Daddy and all of Anne Sexton's reimagined fairy tales." "In my lit class, we listened to a recording of Sylvia Plath. Her voice wasn't what I thought it would sound like." "I know those recordings. I used to listen to them online sometimes late at night. Every word she spoke was a dagger." "What did you think she'd sound like?" I ask her. She shrugs. "Like you, I guess." We drift into silence. The colder it gets, the more difficult it is not to worry. What if we can't pick locks? What if the electricity doesn't come back on for days? What if we get too cold while sleeping and don't wake up in time to save ourselves? "Maybe we should turn our phones off," I say, "in case we need them later." Mabel nods. She looks at her phone, and I wonder if she's thinking about calling Jacob before she turns it off. The light of the screen casts across her face, but I can't read her expression. Then she holds down a button, and her face goes dark again. I cross the room to look for mine. I don't keep it near me all the time the way she does, or the way I used to. I don't get many texts or calls. I find it next to the bag of Claudia's pottery. I pick it up, but before I can power it off, it buzzes. "Who is it?" Mabel asks. "I don't know," I say. "An area code from here." "You should answer it." "Hello?" "Don't know how long you were planning on sticking it out," a man says, "but I imagine it's getting to be pretty chilly in there, and it looks mighty dark." I turn to the window. The groundskeeper is standing in the snow. I can barely see him but for the headlights of his truck. "Mabel," I whisper. She looks up from her phone and joins me at the window. I pick up one of the tea lights and wave it in front of the window, a tiny hello I'm not sure he can see from there. He lifts his hand in a wave. "The power's out for you too, though, isn't it?" I ask.
"Yes," he says, "but I don't live in a dormitory."
We blow out the candles. We pull on our boots and grab our toothbrushes, and then we are out in the impossible cold, leaving trails of footprints in the snow from the dorm entrance to where his truck is idling. He's younger up close. Not young, but not old either.
"Tommy,"
he says. He sticks out his hand and I shake it.
Marin, I say.
Mabel.
Marin, Mabel, you're in luck, because there's a fireplace in my living room and also a fold-out couch.
Even though I'm glad to hear this, it doesn't hit me until after we step inside his little cottage on the edge of the grounds that this is what we needed. I'd gotten so cold I almost forgot what it felt like to be warm enough. His fireplace is crackling and bright, casting light across the ceiling and the walls.
I've got the oven on, too. This old thing could heat the house on its own. Just be careful not to touch it.
All the walls are wood-paneled, and everything is worn in and soft. Rugs upon rugs, sofas and overstuffed chairs, all of them strewn with blankets. He doesn't offer to show us around, but it's a small space, and we can see most of it from where we stand, waiting for him to show us whether we'll spend the evening making small talk or if he'll say goodnight and retreat to the door at the end of the short hallway.
It's just 6:30, Tommy says. I assume you didn't eat.
We had some food a couple hours ago, I say, but no dinner yet.
I'm not big on dinner myself, but I have some pasta and a jar of sauce.
He shows us how to light the burner with a match on his old-fashioned stove and fills a heavy silver pot with water. He keeps his spaghetti in a canister. There isn't much inside.
As I said, I'm not too big on dinner. Hopefully this will be enough for the two of you.
I can't tell if he's lying. I should have thought about all the food in the dorm refrigerator before we left, but I can't fathom going back out into the snow and the dark, walking all that way.
Are you sure? Mabel asks. We could make it work for all of us. We don't need that much.
No, I'm sure.
He takes a look in the canister again and frowns. Then he opens his freezer.
Jackpot!
He pulls out a bag of frozen dinner rolls.
And the oven's already preheated, I say.
Meant to be. I'm going to have a couple rolls and some slices of cheese. You'll have pasta and the rest of the rolls and whatever else you see that pleases you.
He opens the refrigerator so we can take a look. There isn't much inside of it, but it's clean and neatly arranged.
Sounds great, Mabel says, but I just nod.
This is the first time I've been in a home since leaving mine, and my eyes are adjusting to the dark, and every new thing I make out fills me with wonder. A few dishes are in his sink. A pair of slippers rest by the doorway. The freezer has three photographs on it. A little boy, Tommy with some friends, a man in a military uniform. Books are strewn across the coffee table along with two video game controllers. Nothing in his refrigerator is labeled. Everything here is his own. There was a blue and gold blanket that lived on Gramps' recliner in the living room for my entire life. I spent so many winter hours nestled under it, reading my books, drifting to sleep. It was almost threadbare in some places, but it still brought me warmth. I don't know where it is now. I want it.
Marin, Tommy says. I needed to get a hold of you anyway. I'm heading off campus for Christmas and will likely be spending the night away. I'll be with some friends in Beacon. Call me if anything goes wrong, and here are the numbers for the police and the fire station. Call these direct lines, not 911.
Okay, thank you, I say, careful not to look at Mabel. I wish I could ask if she knows what happened to all of our things. Did anyone save anything? Did they wonder where I was? Anna and Javier. They waited in the police station for me. Where did they go next, once they discovered I was gone? The looks that must have been on their faces. I don't even want to imagine it. Why won't I just say yes? Why won't I fly home to them and apologize for my disappearing act and accept their forgiveness when they offer it, and sleep in the bed they made for me in the room with my name on the door. If I could undo that decision in the police station, I wouldn't have left through the back. The 2 weeks in the motel would never have happened, and the thought of diner coffee wouldn't make me choke. Tommy's putting the frozen rolls in the oven. He's sparking the flame of a burner using a match, saying,
"Good thing it's gas."
And Mabel is nodding yes. And I am too. But I'm not hungry. "I'm still feeling really cold for some reason," I say. "I'm just going to sit by the fire, if that's okay."
"Be my guest. As soon as these rolls are done, I'm going to head to the back and you guys can make yourselves comfortable. I've got some presents to wrap, and I was just waiting for an excuse to go to bed early. Power outage will do it."
So I drift to an armchair and I look at the fire. And I think of all of these things from what used to be my home. The blanket, the copper pots, passed down from Gramps' mother. The round kitchen table and the rectangular dining table. The chairs with their threadbare cushions and wicker backs. My grandmother's china, covered in tiny red flowers. The mismatched mugs. The delicate teacups. The tiny spoons. The wooden clock with its loud tick, tick, tick. And the oil painting of the village Gramps was from. The hand-tinted photographs in the hallway. The needlepoint pillows on the sofa. The ever-changing grocery list stuck to the refrigerator under a magnet in the shape of a Boston Terrier. The blanket, again. Blue and gold and soft. And now Tommy is saying goodnight and walking down the hallway. And Mabel is in the living room with me, setting small bowls of pasta onto the coffee table and lowering herself to the floor. I eat without tasting anything. I eat even though I don't know if I'm hungry. Chapter 10. June. It was a couple weeks after the night at Ben's and the Colombian driver, and Mabel and I decided to sneak out on our own. Anna and Javier always stayed up late, sometimes into the early morning. So I fell asleep a little after 10, knowing that my phone would buzz hours later to announce her arrival, and I'd slip out then. Gramps cooked dinner at 6 o'clock most nights. We usually ate in the kitchen, unless he made something fancy, in which case he'd tell me to set the dining room table, and we'd eat with shiny brass candlesticks between us. After dinner, he washed and I dried until the kitchen was as clean as it could be given its age and constant use. And then Gramps drifted off to his back rooms to smoke cigarettes and write letters and read. My phone buzzed, and I left quietly, not knowing whether I was breaking a rule. It's possible that Gramps would have been fine with Mabel and me going to the beach at night to sit and watch the waves and talk. I could have asked him. But we didn't work that way. Mabel was on the sidewalk, her dark hair spilling from under a knit cap, her hands in fingerless gloves clasped together. I had a parka zipped over my sweater. "You look like an Eskimo," she said. "How am I going to offer to help keep you warm?" We laughed. "I can ditch it if you want, baby," I joked. "Why don't you run upstairs? Get rid of that jacket and come back with some of Gramps' whiskey." Actually, the whiskey's not a bad idea. I let myself back in and crossed the living room, slipped through the open pocket doors to the dining room, and grabbed the bottle of whiskey that lived on the built-in hutch. Then I was back on the street, stuffing the bottle under my jacket. Two girls walking to the beach at night was one thing. Add an open and visible bottle, and we'd be inviting the cops to stop us. It was almost 3 in the morning, and the city was still. Not a single car passed us all 4 blocks to the beach. We didn't have to bother with crosswalks. We stepped straight from the street to the sand, scaled a dune, and then found ourselves near the edge of the black water. I was waiting for my eyes to adjust to the dark, but it wasn't happening. So eventually I had to give in to it. "Remember how we used to practice kissing?" I asked, pulling the top off the whiskey. "We were determined to be experts by the time we were sophomores." "Experts," I said, laughing. I took a sip, and the burn of it surprised me. We were used to pilfered beers or vodka mixed with whatever juice was in our friends' pantries.
"Here, drink at your own peril," I rasped.
Mabel took a sip, coughed.
"We were so giggly and nervous," I said, remembering us as freshmen. "We had no idea what it meant to be in high school. What we were supposed to act like. What we were supposed to talk about.
It was so much fun."
"What was?"
"All of it. Let me have another try with that." Her hand felt around in the dark for the bottle, and then she found it, and I let go. She tipped her face toward the hazy moon, handed the bottle back. I took a swig.
"Better this time," she said.
And she was right. And with each subsequent sip, it got easier to swallow, and soon my body felt heavy, and my head swam. And everything Mabel said made me laugh, and every memory I had was meaningful. We were quiet then, for a little while, until she sat up.
"It's been a long time since we practiced," she said, crawling toward me until our noses touched.
A laugh started in my throat, but then she put her mouth on mine. Wet lips. Soft tongue. Her legs wrapped around my waist, and we kissed harder. Soon we were lying in the sand, her salt, thick, tangled hair through my fingers. She unzipped my parka. Her cold hands found their way under my sweater as she kissed my neck.
"What would Sister Josephine say?" I whispered.
I felt her smile against my collarbone. It took her a couple tries to get my bra unclasped with one hand, but when she did, the cold air against my skin was nothing compared to the warmth of her breath. I unbuttoned her sweater, pushed her bra over her breasts without unfastening it. I had never felt so ravenous. It's not like my experience was vast. It's not like I was used to being touched this way. But even if I had already been kissed by dozens of mouths, I would have known this was different. I loved her already. With our jeans unfastened, Mabel's fingers grazing the elastic of my underwear, she said, "If we regret this tomorrow, we can blame it on the whiskey." But the sky was fading from black to gray. It was already tomorrow, and I didn't regret anything. We opened our eyes to the morning fog, a flock of sanderlings darting across the sky. Mabel's hand was in mine, and I was looking at her fingers, smaller than mine, and a few shades darker, and I wanted them under my clothes again, but didn't dare say it. Without the darkness, we felt exposed, and the early morning commuters were already heading to work. The overnight shifters were finally off. We had to wait at every crosswalk.
"What are they all thinking of us?" I asked.
"Well, we're clearly not homeless. Your jacket's too nice." "And we did not just roll out of bed."
"Right," she said, "because we are covered in sand."
The light changed and we crossed the great highway.
"Maybe they think we're beach creatures," I said.
"Mermaids?
We're missing the tails."
"Maybe they think we're scavengers, up early to comb the sand."
"Yes," I said. "Like you probably have a few gold watches in your pockets, and I have some wedding bands and rolls of cash."
"Perfect." I was aware of how our voices were a little higher pitched than usual. Our words rushed. I was aware of how we hadn't looked into each other's faces since we stood up and dusted the sand off our clothes, of the sand that still clung to my skin, and the scent of Mabel everywhere. Gramps spotted us before I saw him. He was waving at us from across the street with one arm, pulling the garbage bin out to the curb with the other.
"Hello, girls," he shouted,
as though it were a pleasant surprise to see us out this early. We didn't know what to say as we walked toward him.
"Morning, Gramps,"
I finally mustered, but by then his expression had changed.
"My whiskey,"
I followed his gaze. I hadn't even realized Mabel was carrying it like that, by its neck, totally exposed. He could have looked at us and seen our kiss-swollen lips and blushing faces, could have seen how neither of us could look him, or each other, in the eye, but he was looking at the bottle instead.
"Sorry, Gramps," I said. "We only took a few swigs."
"We're lightweights," Mabel tried to joke, but her voice was thick with regret. He reached out and she surrendered the bottle. He held it eye level to get a good look at how much was inside.
"It's okay," he said. "It was only a little."
"I'm really sorry," Mabel said. I wished I were back on the beach with her. I willed the sky to turn dark again.
"Gotta be careful with this stuff," Gramps said. "Best not to get involved with it at all."
I nodded, trying to remember kissing Mabel's mouth. I wanted her to look at me. "I have to get home," she said.
"Have a good day at school," Gramps told her.
"Thanks." She was standing on the sidewalk in torn-up jeans and a sweater, her dark hair falling to one side, so long it grazed her elbow. Her brow was furrowed, and her eyes were sad until she caught me, finally looking, and she smiled. "I hope you don't get in trouble," I said. "But how could trouble find us? We were miraculous. We were beach creatures. We had treasures in our pockets. And each other on our skin." Chapter 11. Above me is the head and neck of a deer. A buck, I guess. His antlers cast long and graceful shadows along the wall. I imagine him alive in a field somewhere. I think about spring, grass, and flowers, hoof prints and movement and a body intact. But now there is stillness and drips of candle wax and quiet. There are the ghosts of who we used to be. There is the clink of Mabel setting our dinner bowls into Tommy's sink, and the exhaustion that comes with knowing that something will have to happen next, and then after that, and on until it's over. We haven't talked about sleeping yet. On the sofa are a set of sheets and a comforter, a reminder of the space we are supposed to share. Maybe we'll stay up all night. Mabel returns from the kitchen. She crosses to the bookshelf and picks up a deck of cards. She turns to show me, and I nod. She shuffles and deals 10 for me, 10 for herself, places a card face up. Queen of Spades. I can't believe I didn't buy a deck of cards for us. It would have answered the question of what to do each time it came up. We wouldn't have had to trick ourselves into sleep to stave off the need for conversation. We dive into gin rummy as though no time had passed. I finish the first round ahead 12 points, and Mabel gets up to find us a pencil and paper. She comes back with a Sharpie and a postcard mailer for a Christmas tree lot. "Nothing beats the smell of fresh-cut pine," it says. And below the sentence are photographs of 3 types of fir trees: Douglas, Noble, and Grand. Mabel writes our names below a P.S. "We have wreaths, too," and adds the score. It's a close game, which means it's a long one, and by our last hand my vision keeps blurring from tiredness and the strain of seeing in the dark. Mabel keeps losing track of whose turn it is, even though there are only 2 of us, but in the end, she calls Jin and wins the game. "Nice job," I say, and she smiles. "I'm gonna get ready for bed." The whole time she's gone, I don't move. Maybe she wanted me to pull out the bed, but I'm not going to do it. It's a decision we have to make together. She comes back a few minutes later. "Careful," she says. "Some candles burned out. It's really dark back there." "Okay," I say. "Thanks." I wait for her to do or say something. Finally, I ask, "So, should we get the bed ready?" Even in the dark, I can see her concern. "Do you see other options?" I ask her. "There are only a couple of chairs and the floor."
That rug is pretty soft, she says.
If that's what you want.
It isn't what I want, it's just...
He doesn't have to know, and it's only sleeping anyway. I shake my head. After everything, this is so stupid.
How many times did we sleep in the same bed before anything happened?
Hundreds? I think we'll be okay tonight.
I know.
I promise not to mess anything up for you.
Marin, come on.
It's your call, I say. I don't really want to sleep on the rug, but if you don't want to share the bed, I can sleep on the couch without pulling it out so you can have more room. Or maybe we could push two chairs together or something.
She's quiet. I can see that she's thinking, so I give her a minute.
You're right, she finally says. I'm sorry. Let's just get the bed ready.
You don't have to be sorry, I mutter. And now I'm taking the cushions off the sofa, and Mabel is moving the coffee table to the side of the room to make space for the bed to fold out. We find handles on each side and pull. Squeaky bed springs. Flimsy mattress. She shakes out the fitted sheet and we put it on together, tuck in the sides because the mattress is so thin.
The rug's looking better and better, I say.
Getting cold feet?
I feel myself smile, and when I look at her, she's smiling back at me already.
I can do the rest, she says, picking up a pillowcase. You go get ready. Like Jane Eyre, I carry a candle to light my way. But when I get to the bathroom and look in the mirror, all I see is myself. Despite the darkness, the long shadows, the quiet, this room is free of intruders and ghosts. I splash icy water on my face, dry it with a towel Tommy left out for us. I brush my teeth, I pee, I wash my hands, and pull my hair back in a rubber band I brought with me. I think of Jane Eyre with Mr. Rochester, of how much she loved him and how certain she was that they could never be together. And I think of how in a couple of minutes I'll be in bed with Mabel. I tried to make it sound like it was nothing, but it is something. I know that. She knows it. Maybe her hesitation wasn't about Jacob at all. It could just have been over the ways we've changed. It could be that she's still too angry to think about the weight of my body on the same mattress, the accidental contact we'll make throughout the night when we're too lost in sleep to keep to one side or the other. I take the candle and head back to the living room. She's already in bed, on her side, facing the edge. I can't see her face, but I think her eyes are closed. I climb onto the other side. The springs groan. No sense in pretending she could sleep through the noise of it. Good night, I whisper. Good night, she says. Our backs are to each other's. We're as far apart as two people could be on a mattress this size. The space between us is worse than our awkwardness, worse than not knowing what she's thinking during our long stretches of silence. I think I hear something. I think she's crying. And here are things I'd forgotten resurfacing. Text messages she sent. Did you meet someone? You can tell me if you did. I just need to know. There were others, too, but I can't remember them. In the beginning, her texts were knives, slicing holes in the cocoon of motel must and diner coffee and the view of the street out my window. But after school started, after Hannah, I was a stranger with a second-hand phone, and someone named Mabel had the wrong number. That girl she was trying to reach, she must have been running from something. She must have been someone special for her friend to keep trying so hard. Too bad she was gone now. We never talked about what would happen to us. That was another one. The way we used to kiss. How I would catch her looking at me from across the room. Her grin. My blush. Her thigh. Soft against my cheek. I had to deny all of it because it was part of a life that was over. All I can hear is the crackle of the fire. She may not have really been crying. I may have imagined it, but I can feel it now, the way I heard her. Maybe it's all of this remembering or talking about books and paintings again, or being with Mabel. But I can feel the ghost of me creeping back. Remember me? She's asking. I think I do. And that girl would have comforted Mabel. She would have touched her as though a touch were something simple. So I lift my hand, search for a safe place on Mabel's body, her shoulder. I touch her there, and before I have time to wonder if it's unwanted, Mabel's hand covers mine, holding it in place.
Chapter 12. June. Later that day, after Gramps had caught us with the whiskey and Mabel and I had spent the school hours blushing every time we saw each other, after Gramps had made a casserole for dinner and there had been more quiet between us than usual, he asked me to sit down on the love seat. I nodded. "Sure," I said, but my chest filled with ice. I didn't know how I'd answer the questions he was about to ask me. Everything was too new. I followed him into the living room and took my seat. He stood in front of me, towering, not even a hint of a smile, only worry and sadness and something verging on panic.
"Listen," he said, "I want to tell you about different kinds of love."
I braced myself for his disapproval. I had rarely felt it before, and never for anything substantial. And I braced myself, too, for my anger. Because as unexpected as Mabel's kiss had been, and as nervous and unsettled as I'd felt ever since, I knew that what we did wasn't wrong.
"You may have gotten the wrong impression," he continued, "about Bertie and me. It isn't like that between us."
I felt a laugh escape me. It was out of relief, but he didn't take it that way.
"It may be difficult to believe," he said. "I know it may have come across as romantic, because of how I act when I get her letters, because of that dress she sent me. But sometimes two people have a deep connection. It makes romance seem trivial. It isn't about anything carnal. It's about souls. About the deepest part of who you are as a person."
He seemed so worried. So nervous. All of my relief slipped away and concern replaced it.
"Okay, Gramps," I said. "Whatever it is, I'm glad that you have her."
He took his handkerchief out of his pocket and carefully unfolded it. He patted his forehead, his upper lip. I had never seen him so worked up about anything.
"Really," I said, "don't worry about what I think. I just want you to be happy."
"Sailor," he said, "if I didn't have her, I would be lost."
I wasn't enough of a companion. I wasn't any kind of anchor. I felt the blow of it, but I swallowed the hurt and said, "I'm sure she feels the same for you." He studied my face. It felt like he was looking through me to something else. He nodded slowly.
"It's true. Maybe even more so," he said. "I need her, and she needs me. Boy, does she need me."
Maybe he was going to say more, but the doorbell rang. The card game was about to begin, so I got up and went down to open the gate. Usually I would clear the kitchen when they came, but I was afraid that something was wrong with Gramps. I wanted to know that he was back to himself. I finished drying the dishes on the rack as they poured their first drinks and started to play. Then I left for a while, but couldn't stop worrying, so I went back to make myself tea. As the water heated up, I saw Jones take Gramps' bottle, pour a little more into his glass. Gramps eyed the glass, then eyed Jones.